Mm-hmm. Apparently it's working. That's one thing. Another thing is to start recording on Blackboard Collaborate. Something that I forgot last time. Last time we stopped here in our exercise, the buffer overflow. But before that, I would like to discuss with you the problems that we had last time with networks when we configured the network. So I'll show you, if you have read one of the announcements that I put in the Blackboard Collaborate room. So when you create a virtual machine and define that this virtual machine has two or three network interface cards, you should check what are the MAC addresses of these network interface cards. So here, for example, finishes with EB for this one, and here with F0. Now, when you start this virtual machine after the installation, we start one of these. I have created two test machines just to check once again whether this will work. Well, it works for me, so you can try. Now you start a terminal and give the old-fashioned command ifconfig or ip whatever, and check here. You see this ether, this is the MAC address. So what you get here for ETH0, it finishes with F0. Okay, so that's one address of one interface card, and the other with EB, and that's exactly what we need. So ETH1 should be with NAT, network address translation, and that's exactly that. This is NAT, and its address is finishes with EB. Now, typically, when you install a virtual machine, that will be the other way around. So it will. That was the source of trouble last time, for some reason. Now, this can be corrected. So what I can do when I install, I'm going to create a new machine now, just to show you. So let's create a new machine, call it test3, for example. I hope I shall have space on my hard disk. And then we say it's Linux, and we say it's Debian, 64 bits. And then we say 18192. Awesome. 8 gigas. Create virtual hard disk, VDI, fixed size. And then we say, as usual, 40. That's something that we need. So that's what we have done before. Now it will take some, like half a minute to create that disk. Hopefully there will be still this space. Now, what I'm going to install is the latest version of this operating system. So it doesn't matter. It can be the old one, the new one. It's always the same problem. It says 20 seconds to go, so it will not take some long time. So this is our virtual machine. Test 3. Now I put some additional parameters so it can be handy to allow this at least temporarily shared clipboard. And then we have in this system, we said we have two processors as usual. Then we have 128 megabytes and enable 3D acceleration. And then the storage, here you put in the empty, this CD-ROM, you put your ISO file. So last time we used the old one and the new one. We tried with the new one, that's the newest version, but it will, there is no difference. Now, USB, we don't use it, but you can enable USB 3 and share folders, as we said. Other path. Now, where is your share directory? So you put that path, and that's it. Now, what is important here is network, of course. So let's say that we want something like Kali 3. Okay, so that's the only one that I didn't create. So this is by default. So the adapter 1 is not, adapter 2 enable, and say internal network, and in our case for Kali 3 it was Internet 1. Okay, now these network interface card simulations, you can put any, but just to be consistent with the previous, I choose this, Intel Pro MT server, whatever. So this will not affect anything here. So Internet 1, okay? Now, of course, you install the operating system. So we install. And it will probably complain that you have several interface cards and one of them, DHCP doesn't work, etc. So I'll tell you what to do. Okay, so as usual, English, other, what other, Europe, then Norway. Norway, Norway, where are you? Here, Norway. Then this is encoding. And then Norwegian keyboard. Okay, so it will then work. And then it starts installation, and then it will come to the network part. And it will start to configure the networks automatically, and then it will probably fail. Now, configure the network, and it says, your system has multiple network interfaces. Okay, we choose ETH 0, default, and say continue. Now, if you choose ETH 1, it will probably install. But then your ETH 1, wherever in the exercises you have ETH 0, you have to put ETH 1. So I would like to avoid that. That's why we do it this way. Okay, configuring now, of course, it is in trouble. So it is trying, and in the end it will say, I failed. So your network is probably not using the DHCP, etc., etc. So I'll say, okay, you say continue. And now what is important is to say, do not configure the network at this time. So just let it install the operating system without configuring the networks, with some default values. So then host name, we said it is test 3. Yes, huh? Continue, full name. So you create a kind of user, give it some name, and then the password, and repeat the password. Continue. Now the rest is just as it as usual. So it will not complain on anything. It will just ask you, guided all the default values. Okay, default, finish partitioning, say yes, write changes to disk, and it is now going to partition the disk, install the base system, and then it will ask you whether to install something else. Just say no. So, but this installation takes some minutes, so just be patient. By the way, when you install these new versions of Kali, you don't have to install the VirtualBox extensions because it installs them automatically at installation. So just mounting this CD, etc., etc., just forget it. Later, when you, for example, renew the VirtualBox, then it may be necessary to run the extensions again. Okay, now here it says, would you like to install something else? No, just continue. And now it will install software. Now these files, that since it is not connected to the network, it retrieves these files from the ISO, from the disk. And now installing all that. So it will take a couple of minutes. And then after that, we start the operating system and we shall show with ifconfig, for example, or IP, that nothing works. So it will show that ETA0 has some MAC address that doesn't, that's not good, and ETH1 the same. Now what we do, we opened our instructions, set up test network, and edit the file for, we are assuming we are installing this Kali 3, for example. We haven't done that so far. So we edit the file etc network interfaces and copy this part from here. That's why it's handy to enable clipboard copy, because then we don't have to type this. And then restart. Now, of course, it's installing, so that's what we are going to do. So copy that in the file interfaces, then restart the machine and see what happens. We check the MAC addresses. So that was the problem. Last time everybody had this problem because there was a discrepancy between the MAC addresses on these simulated network interface cards and the MAC addresses that were given in the system. And why is that? Because during the installation time you should have set do not install network at this time. Because if you choose something else, then everything is messed up because all that is a simulation, the files are changed and nothing will work. So that's the problem. So the key step is in the installation time, if the error appears, just say do not install network at this time. So I have tried that twice today and it worked, and this is the third time. Let's see if I shall be lucky now when it has to work. So that's usually a problem. Did you try? You? Did you try to do the same?
Yeah, but I ran into a problem when I was cloning, it's 40 gig, so I ran out of space. I'm thinking of running another one for just like 10 gig. Because 40 gig, my storage...
Yeah, you just remove all the previous virtual machines. That's easy.
Yeah, but the problem I was facing was not from that. When I ran ifconfig, I didn't put the minus A for me to see the... So I was reconfiguring my NAT. So when I do the configuration at zero, that is actually my at one is the NAT.
So my recommendation for you is remove all these virtual machines, create a new one, and install this way. And say during the installation, do not install network at this time. So the only thing that takes time is actually installation of all these programs, but we have to wait. So we are halfway. Hey, I'm just explaining what the problem was with the networking. And we are now trying to do one procedure that works.
Your mind is working.
So maybe if you have read my message about this error, then... So alternatively, you can solve this problem in other way. So when during the installation it complains that DHCP is not working, then you choose ETH1, the second one, to be the, if you have two network interface cards, you choose the second one to be the network interface card. It will work. However, then ETH1 will be the card that you want to use in our experiments, not ETH0. So that's also possible. It doesn't matter. So... in theory, but if you really want to canonically follow what I have written in these instructions, then you should proceed this way. Then you will have ETH0 as a network interface card for the connection with INTNET1, and INTNET2 if it is Kali2, and then ETH1 as the connection with the internet of all these machines. Because this connection is handy, since we have to install something on these virtual machines like Snort, Suricata, Zeek, etc., etc. So this should be... Of course, we can do it the other way. We can use the share folder and do not download anything, but this is much more practical. Okay, we are going towards the end of this. So it will... be finished in a couple of minutes. Just be patient. Now, when we finish with this, we are going to show this buffer overflow. And with this, we finish the exercise from last week. And then today, I'm going to start talking about the search technique. So it will be a kind of lecture. Because yesterday, I was in Trondheim. I couldn't be here at that time. So there was a PhD defense there. It's advancing slowly but surely. Yeah. This problem has not shown itself before in the previous versions of both VirtualBox and Kali, so this is the first time that it happens this year. I don't know why. So something happened probably with software versions. So last year we didn't have any problem. Year before that, no problems. cleaning up. So we are close to the finish, okay? Then it will complain about group. Well, not complain, but just ask us where to install it. So we say yes, okay, and we say this one, this disk, and then it will install the bootloader and finishes the installation. You see, guest editions are installed now in the installation process. So you don't have to care about inserting CD, etc., etc., what we tried last time. However, next time when you update the VirtualBox, then you may need to install the new version of the extensions. Finishing the installation. Continue to reboot. Then we reboot, and now it will start the operating system, and the network will probably not work. Now, if you look at ifconfig or IP, you see Ether, that's the MAC address, ends with B4 for ETH0, and this MAC address ends with F1 for ETH1, but nothing works here. So you have to go to ETC network and edit the file interfaces. Now, this, what we are doing is installing, say, Kali 3. So that was the idea, the one that we haven't installed so far. This should be for Kali 3, okay? So we copy this part. That's Internet 1, okay, and DHCP. Oh, did I activate the, let's see, this in general, share clip of bidirectional. Ah, then I should probably have to restart. Because that has happened before, so it will, did I copy? Actually, I selected, but I maybe didn't say copy. But I don't think it will work, so I say paste, but no. Okay, then we restart. So that has happened before, so we have to restart just to avoid typing. So once I restarted, suddenly this Control C worked and Control V for some reason. It's also specific, even though I specified that I want bidirectional clipboard copy. It didn't work the first time. So let's see again. Now it works for some reason. Now, update is there, okay, and then this is the primary. See, so that's Internet 1, because Kali 3 belongs to Internet 1. So all the parameters are from that file, instruction file. Now, save, exit, restart the system, and see what happens. Hopefully, it will now work, but you never know. takes time, it has happened before, but anyway. Now, it works. So you see, it has the right address. This is a static address that we wanted, and this is the internet address, and we can check that by trying to access internet. So this should work. So let's say NRCO. It's working. So this is what worked for me. You try for you. It also worked when I had three interface cards for router. So you also have to take care of the addresses. So that's important. So the first one is NAT, the second one is Internet 1, and the third one is Internet 2. You check whether these MAC addresses conform to what you get with ifconfig or IP. So IP, you get the same thing. IPA. So ETA 0, this is the CIDR, that's how it is called, this address, 192.168.112. It has terrible colors, nothing can be read, 10.0.2.15, so that's okay. Okay, so that was just to show you that the network can be configured without choosing my files. That was important. So I don't have to change what I have already uploaded in Blackboard. Yeah. So it's solvable this way. Now, the buffer overflow is what remains of our exercise. It has nothing to do with our virtual machines. It is pure Windows. So we are going to run a program in Windows. It's just a function that uses the system, one of the system functions, string copy. And this string copy has no limit check for this array. So it is a buffer overflow vulnerability that can be exploited. Now we are going to show a primitive exploit. So this exploit actually changes the return address. So in theory, on this, you first define the return address. And on this return address, you put your malicious code. And then the return address of this program is replaced by that return address by introducing the input parameters to the program that corresponds to this address. I'm going to show you. Now, the main program just calls this function in which another function is called. So you can just copy-paste this in, for example, Visual Studio or whatever program. Visual Studio is... I use Visual Studio, so these instructions here apply one-to-one to Visual Studio. Now, I'm sure that other environments can be used the same way. So we have a project. If you can download that from our Blackboard learning materials. So we start with this buffer overflow 1.sln. Now, what happens with this environment that I'm using and probably in many others is that these addresses that are assigned to variables, they vary. Each time you restart the program, you get new addresses. So that's why the instructions are not concrete. Use this address, etc., etc. It says find out what is the address and then use that. Because every time it will be different. Okay? Now, what we are going to do, well, just follow the instructions. So, the program, of course, creates a vector of bytes of length 49. Now, how many bytes will be reserved on the stack for that vector is, it must be 52. Because by default, it's a 32-bit program, even though the host is 64-bit. So, each variable is 4 bytes. Now, these 4 bytes are actually taken even though you want to reserve less. So, if you reserve 48, then it will be 48. But since it is 49, it's not divisible by 4, so the next one is 52. So, you will have 3 bytes for nothing that are not used. Okay? So the string copy function does not perform any boundary checks, so the program possesses, as we said, the buffer overflow vulnerability. Now, to demonstrate this vulnerability and the exploit, we are going to do this. Take the property pages of the project. In Visual Studio, it's here. So you click here, say properties. Now, the first one that we have to check, of course, I have already set everything that is needed. So go to code generation, C++ code generation security check and disable security check. And why? Because since we manipulate the stack, it will be by default discovered by Windows and it will block that. So we don't want it to be blocked because these things that we demonstrate here, they can be done in any environment, not just a serious operating system that prevents. There are many methods for this. Okay? So we say C++ and then code generation, you see, disable security check. So I have done that. So there are enable or disable or inherit, etc., etc. So that's one thing. And the other thing is basic runtime checks. You have to set it to this, initialized variables, because by default it's something else. You put initialized variables. This RTCU. And finally, in the command line of the program, you set the input. So the input is like this. 4 A's, 4 B's, 4 C's, etc. Why is that? Now I'm an attacker and I'm trying to discover the vulnerability. So I don't know how long this buffer is. I know that you have a buffer overflow vulnerability. So I try. I try with 4 A's. Everything works fine. So the program doesn't follow my instructions. And then A, B, 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 nothing happens, etc., etc. I add 4 letters at a time until I get to this part that actually overrides the return address. So then the program will start behaving strangely. So you can try that at home. You start with just 4 A's and then add 4 B's, add 4 C's, and you will see that the program will work normally until you get to this point. If we had a shorter buffer, then it would happen before. So we should compile and debug this problem. Of course, you set that in debugging command arguments. You see, it's up to N. I have already set that to all these letters. So it will go crazy. If I just let it run, it will say something is wrong. Now, because with this I overwrite, as you are going to see, I overwrite the return address. Now, how do we see these return addresses? So we debug in such a way that we open Windows and choose the disassembly window and the memory window. So we look at the memory portion where our variables are reserved on stack, and we look at assembly instructions, not the high-level operating system instructions. So, okay, so we run one instruction, and then the debugger starts, and we say debug Windows, and then we choose disassembly, you see. You get the assembly instructions. So after each high-level language instruction, you get the corresponding assembly instructions. So under this int main, you have all this part. Under FN1, the definition, you have this part, etc., etc. Now, what we do, we execute. We can do it with F10 in Windows, Visual Studio. We execute instruction by instruction until, as we said, call FN1. You see? Until the assembly language instruction call FN1. And that's here. You see, it's call FN1. Okay? Now, next, what's the address of the next instruction? So after the execution of this call, the program has to return to this address, 00EB17A7. So we say 00EB. So if you are doing this at home or here in the class, you will see that for you it's something different. So for everybody it's different. And next time when I run this program, this will be different for me as well. So that it's Windows that allocates these addresses. So the instruction says, observe the address of the next assembly instruction. That address is put on the stack first immediately after entering the FN1 function, and the attacker will try to find the location where that address is stored and replace it with his own. So that's why we are adding four letters at a time to reach this address, to change it. Okay, so we go in FN1 now when we have remembered this address. Okay, so we go with F11, and then F10, and we are now in FN1, okay? In our function. So next, you see, it will reserve this character array. 49 elements, but actually 52 bytes will be reserved. So here, execute the program until the instruction call string copy. So it's here, you see, until this point. So we can execute instruction by instruction. There are not so many instructions. Here. So until this point, call string copy. Okay? Now, where is our array local? So we can easily get the address of this. Just hover the mouse over the name. Now you get that it is at 00FBF7D8. 00FB, in my case, of course, 00FBF7D8. F7D8. Okay? Now, what we have to do is look at that address in memory. So it's 00FB. Small, big letters, doesn't matter. F7D8. 00FB, F7D8. So there is something there. Now, it would be interesting to find out where is our return address on this, because this is stack, what we are seeing now. So where is our return address? We have 52 bytes that are reserved for this variable, local, okay? So it's 4, 8, 12, 16, 20, 24, I hope I count well, 28, 32, 36, 40, 44, 48, 52. So all that is reserved. Now the next one is EBP, one register. So you should read from right to left. 00FBF864, that's not what we are looking for. But the next 4-bit, 00EB17A7. That's the one. So these here. So if you read from the right, so it's 00EB17A7. Now, the attacker will actually, since the parameter has been passed in this FN1, which is greater than this local, because it's from A's to N's, so it's more than 52 bytes, you will see that it will rewrite both EBP and the return address at least 1 byte. Okay, and that's enough. So if you put return address to be exactly what you get, 00EB1700, and here you start your malicious program, then you are done as an attacker. Okay. So with this call, all this is random content. When I execute call string copy, all this will be replaced with AAAA, BBBB. It's of course ASCII codes for that. Okay. So I can execute, you see. Now, see, 41, that's A. 42, it's B. 43, C, etc., etc. And see, our return address. We have replaced the last byte of the return address by this, because this is our Y00. Ah, that's the question. Does anybody know why this 00? Because it's a null terminated string. In C, every string is terminated with 00, with a 0 byte. So it's the delimiter for the string. So that's why it's not only the EBP. This is the code for N, for E. That's easy. You have these ASCII tables everywhere. You can check. So you can check this way. A, B, C, D, etc., etc. So you get to N. See, if I had only M as the last one, nothing would happen. But I added N, which adds 5 extra bytes. So 00 is the null. So if I put my malicious code to this address, 00EB1700, then it would start, you will see. So now I execute one more and then return, you see. Return. It went there. 00EB1700. Now at this address I can start my malicious program. Of course, if it is not forbidden to write it in this memory location. But I can choose the initial content for our program not to be just AAAABBBBCCC, etc., etc. I can put exactly the address. So I can now do whatever as an attacker. Of course, by default, the system has some protection against this. So it doesn't allow you to rewrite the stack. So it will warn that stack is corrupt, etc., etc. But with these parameters that we set here, disable security check and basic runtime checks, we actually disable these checks. So this is how buffer overflow works. Now if I try to execute, it will complain. So it has triggered a breakpoint, something crazy. So I can even run the program this way, because with these input parameters, it will go crazy. So I just say F5. You see, source not available, something very, very strange. So it should not happen. So I have to actually shorten the input to avoid this. So I hope you have understood how this works. Now it's 14:00. I give you 10 minutes break and then we do some lecturing the rest of this time. So you can try this at home. You can play a bit with this. Remember that these addresses will always be different.
Yeah, if it's always different, how will an attacker direct an attack and be successful?
Because he manipulates, he will know where this address is. And if he knows where this address is, he, by this input to the program arguments, he can put the input in such a way that he rewrites this address. So he puts his own. Doesn't matter which address is here because it's rewritten anyway by the attacker. So, 10 minutes break. Now, before we start with the lecture, I need 3 volunteers for reference group. We shall meet 3 times during the semester, half an hour online. You give me feedback, what you like, what you dislike in this course, ask the colleagues, and forward that information to me. What do you think? Doesn't apply to PhD students, so we have 3 candidates in this room, 3 volunteers, I would say. No, it's not difficult, so. Think about that. If you accept, it will be highly appreciated. Okay, so now I don't have to, I must not actually forget clicking this. Well, we have finished with our introductory lecture So that was about what IDS is, et cetera, et cetera. And we have seen that there are misuse detection systems and anomaly detection systems. We explained what they are. And now we are going into details. So our next topic is three lectures about misuse detection. After that, we have three lectures about anomaly detection. And then after that, we have, as we said, testing and abstract IDS models and virtual networks. So these three are actually relatively short. But misuse detection and anomaly detection, these are the biggest topics in our course. And we start with misuse detection, where in the first lecture we are going to discuss the search algorithms. I don't know how long it will take today. If we don't finish with this, we continue on Monday. Okay, so we have already stressed the importance of search techniques in IDS. Now we are going to get some details about this. And then the central topic in this lecture is the AHO-Korosik algorithm. Why that? Because this algorithm is implemented absolutely everywhere in intrusion detection. So that's the basic algorithm for search intrusion detection systems, and you will see its good and good points and bad points. And then we shall see something about the perspective of using special algorithm that exploit what is called bit parallelism. We are going to see what it is. And then finally we are going to discuss approximate search. So that's something that is not very often used, but it is also promising technique for discovering attacks. So we said already that misuse detection is based on the assumption that abnormal traffic patterns are known in advance. So you must know the attack. So it will not work against zero-day attacks. So that's something for which we use anomaly detection system. Now, why is that? Because then we know the difference between what is normal and what is abnormal, and then we create what is called a signature for each attack or a variant of attack that we want to discover. And we place these signatures in what we call misuse database. It doesn't have to be database as you got used to databases. So it can be a sequence of files. As we are going to see, it's very often the case with non-commercial intrusion detection systems. Now, a misuse-based IDS, as we have said, checks every data unit. A data unit can be, if you are lucky, just a single packet, but normally not. It will be several packets, what we call a session or a flow. It checks every such data unit against the records of the misuse database. So if it knows 1,000 attacks or 10,000 attacks, so each unit of data that is input to this misuse detection is checked in the worst case against all these. So you can imagine how much effort is needed for that. So because nowadays we know thousands and thousands of attacks. So this actually requires a very, very efficient search algorithm. So it has to be very fast. The choice, consequently, of the search algorithm is very important in a misuse-based IDS. In most practical cases today, if you download, for example, the systems that we are going to study in this course, Snort, Suricata, Zeek, etc., they all used what is called exact search. So to discover an attack or to detect an attack by means of exact search, all the variations of this attack, which may be many, must have a distinct signature. Because one bit of difference will make that you do not detect the attack, because we are talking about exact search. So you can imagine that you search in the packets or in this reassemble stream of packets, you search for indications of attack. It may be not just single indication of attack, maybe several. So we will see how signatures look like. I showed you one of the signatures for Snort last time when we talked about the definition of signatures. Now you will see that the signatures may be very complicated and that the number of patterns that we search for can be relatively great. So like 2-3 patterns, even more. And they are usually short. So that's specific. We shall see. So for every variation of the same attack, we need a new signature. That's the essential. To avoid this, so if you don't want the separate signature for each variant of the same attack, you can use what is experimentally tried now, approximate search. So you can try to match the signature of an attack approximately with some tolerance. And then you don't need to store for each variant of the same attack the separate signature. So that's the idea of using approximate search. So we are going to discuss approximate search in the end of this lecture. That's something that is not used in practice very often. However, it's experimental. And it has shown some good results. Now, regarding IDS in general, most of them are actually misuse-based. They are relatively easy to produce, and they are relatively easy to sell, because they can guarantee you something. So it will say, they will say, we guarantee that you will discover this list of attacks, because we have these signatures in our database. So if you find a match in your traffic, that's an attack. However, they don't protect you from zero-day attacks that actually do most harm. The majority of these systems are realized in hardware. So besides all that, you buy hardware. So that's expensive. Why that? Because of efficiency that is needed. You see, search has to be very fast. In addition, some of them can be realized in software for smaller networks and not so fast or intensive traffic. When we discuss misuse detection systems, we usually refer us to network-based systems. So they are misuse-based, network-based systems. So most of IDS of today are like that. And why is that? Because we nowadays do everything with networks. So that's most often used, at least open source, Nord, Suricata, Zeek, whatever. And commercial misuse-based IDS are also network-based, most of them. However, it can be the other way. It can be host-based as well. Host-based misused detection system. That's very similar to virus detection. Because what virus detection system does, it looks for signatures of viruses, but the signature of an attack can be extension of that. So it's not just a single string, it can be indications of various kinds. So it can be, for example, information that the traffic flows from this point to that point, you will see. Something that you never do with antivirus. So, because of that, if you buy a commercial antivirus system for your machine, it will probably contain a host-based misuse detection system. So those like, we are not going to advertise things, but like Symantec and all that, so they all have this. Panda, I don't know, Kaspersky, whatever you install. These are, of course, realized in software. They have to run on host, but still, they use search. Because of that, you have then the search technique implemented in software. It has to be extremely efficient. Now, where is this search algorithm? It is in the detection module, which is the core of the IDS. Its purpose do exactly that. Compare the header, if we are lucky just the header, or content, in most cases, unfortunately, of the analyzed packet or a reassembled set of packets, which we call a session or sometimes a flow, with the attack signatures the IDS knows that are in the database. For such a comparison, how can we compare? You need search algorithm. So, efficiency of the search algorithm is what matters when we assess the quality of an IDS, because we want to avoid the dropping of packets. We mentioned that last time. And this efficiency depends on the choice of the search algorithm. That's one thing. So which one is the most sophisticated in the sense of speed, and which one is best implemented So it's not just theoretically efficient system, it has to be implemented efficiently. So when we talk about our open source systems, you're going to see that we are also going to discuss some, not all, details of the implementation of these algorithms and data structures that they use. Now the question arises, what are the factors that determine IDS efficiency? Here we list some. For example, many times in intrusion detection you need multi-pattern search. Now, if you take at random some search algorithm that may be efficient or very efficient, sublinear time complexity, we are going to discuss that, it may happen that it's only capable of detecting one pattern at a time. If you want multi-pattern, you will have to run it several times. If you have a search algorithm that is, by definition, multi-pattern, that would be very useful. So you run it once per signature. Then sometimes case sensitivity matters in traffic. Then the size of the search patterns. Now the search pattern, so terminology in search. The search pattern is what we are looking for. So what we are searching for. And the search string is the memory in which we are looking for that. So there are two concepts. The search pattern, this is what we want to find, and the search string is where we want to find what we want to find. So the size of the search patterns, so which means how long is usually, because we are talking about text, how long is what we are looking for? So that matters sometimes. Then the number of search patterns processed during a single rule processing. Rule is signature, more or less, in SNORT terminology. And suricata. Then the size of the alphabet sometimes matters. This is very important. The possibility of launching so-called algorithmic attacks against an IDS. So even though the search algorithm that we use in intrusion detection is very efficient, it may be the problem with the difference between its worst case time complexity and average case time complexity. There are algorithms, search algorithms, that are very efficient on average. But they are not so efficient in the worst case. Now, the attacker, by launching special traffic, can make the search algorithm perform as in the worst case. So that's called algorithmic attack. So he or she can try to force the search algorithm to try to find a special string that makes the algorithm work inefficiently. This only applies to the search algorithms that they have difference between the average time complexity and worst case time complexity. The next factor that affects the IDS efficiency is the search text size. Okay? So, or search string sometimes. We call it search text or search string. And how often we do search. So how often we call the search algorithm per unit of time. Because IDS is a complex system, it performs many tasks, sometimes in parallel or very close in time. So let's discuss each of these factors. The need for multi-pattern search exists because a single rule file, the single rule often requires search for multiple patterns. We are going to see that. So it would be very nice and efficient to just run the algorithm once per rule or per signature. Any search algorithm, therefore any search algorithm for IDS must be capable of real-time packet processing, and we can do some pre-processing because of the static nature of the search patterns. They correspond to known attacks, so it doesn't change. Then we do some pre-computation, and if we do some pre-computation, that means that we shall, sometimes we are going to see that when we talk about some algorithms, we shall sometimes exploit this fact to make the search algorithm run just once per signature, even though it has multiple patterns to search for. The purpose is, of course, to speed up the search. The next factor, the case sensitivity of search pattern, well, the name says, why is this important? Because to mitigate IDS evasion, so the attacker can search for a string that is the same but just mixed uppercase and lowercase characters, and then if the IDS is not resistant to that, it will miss the attack. So changing case of the keywords by the attacker may lead to missing the detection by the IDS. So you can search for this, sensitive, for example, or this, sensitive. So that's the same word, but with mixed uppercase and lowercase letter. So this will probably be detected, but this will not be detected. That's the idea of the attacker. Now, the search algorithms, therefore, the search algorithms are at least configured in such a way. You will see in snort case, it converts everything to uppercase. And then, if it finds the match, then snort performs additional check whether the case matters. In this case, so match. So if a search pattern is found in the analyzed packet, an additional check might be needed related to the issues of the case. That's practical thing, so it is done in practice. Then we have the size or the length of the search pattern. It would be ideally independent of the length of the search pattern, so the efficiency of the search algorithm. But it's not always the case. For some search algorithms, the size actually affects their efficiency to a great extent. That's bad. For example, the search algorithms exploiting bit parallelism that we are going to discuss, if the length of the search pattern is greater than the length of the computer word, then it slows down substantially. Then we have the number of search pattern processed during a single rule or signature processing. In general, the performance is reduced as the number of search pattern increases because of harder issues. The usage of processor cache memory due to the fact that the size of this memory is limited for all the processors. So the more expensive processors have more cache memory, the less expensive have less. So hardware requirements dictate this. Then the size of the alphabet, it should not affect, but sometimes it does, then the search algorithm is not good. So any search algorithm used in IDS must be efficient enough to cope with the size of the alphabet. Usually we use Unicode nowadays, so most of the search algorithms are good in this. We have already discussed the possibility of launching algorithmic attacks. So these attacks exploit the fact that some search algorithms have the difference between the average time complexity and the worst case time complexity. Then we can launch specially designed packet that contains patterns that force this algorithm to be less efficient. That's called algorithmic attack. The AHO-CoreSeq algorithm that we have already mentioned, it's very often used. And why is that? Because the average case complexity and the worst case complexity are the same. So it's not sensitive to algorithmic attacks. In addition, it's a multi-pattern search algorithm. So all the patterns are detected in one pass. We shall discuss that when we discuss the AHO-CoreSeq algorithm. The next factor is the size of the search text, so in which we are searching for the search pattern. It can vary. It can be very small, just a few bytes. For example, if you take an ICMP packet, it's a couple of bytes. And in this ICMP packet, you can search for something like IP address. But it can be very long. It can be long HTTP reassembled session. So sometimes it's not the same, the length of the search text. Usually this affects, because whenever you search for a pattern, in the worst case you will have to go through the whole search text, and that's linear growth. Implementation of any search algorithm requires what we call initialization, and this usually takes a fixed number of operations before the very execution of the search. In this case, if you have a very short search text, then the cost per processed byte of search text, it will be high, because you will have to run the same initialization procedure each time. So if you need an initialization procedure that needs 1,000 operations to search for a 2-byte search pattern in a 10-byte string, that's very expensive. But if you have to search for a 2-byte search pattern in 10,000 long string with the same initialization, that's much cheaper per process byte. So that's why the size of the search text affects actually the efficiency of search. Because of that, consequently, search algorithm that doesn't require very long initialization, even though it's slower on average, can be better if we search patterns in shorter strings. The frequency of searches has similar effect. It may be high in high bandwidth networks because you have a lot of packets per unit of time. Then the high frequency of execution of the search algorithm might make this search cost high per process byte also. So better search algorithms have fewer setup operations, fewer initialization steps. So both problems, the size of the search text and the frequency of searches, are solved by using a search algorithm that doesn't require very long initialization. You will see that this famous Aho-Korosek algorithm has actually pretty long initialization. So it's complex initialization. That's one drawback of that. So, bearing in mind all these factors that determine IDS efficiency, the Aho-Korosek search algorithm is very often chosen to be implemented in misuse-based IDS. Actually, in all that I know, and there are many, it's always Aho-Korosek as default algorithm. The Aho-Korosek implementation may vary. So, we shall see that when we discuss the concrete solution. So, it may be implemented in different way in order to make it more efficient. Why is Aho-Korosek so popular? Because first, it's a multi-pattern search algorithm. So its performance can be further improved by pre-processing. We have mentioned pre-processing. Why it is possible? Because the known attacks, they never change. The known attack is not changed. So it may be a new variation of an old attack. All attack, but then that's also 0 day. So a known attack makes the signature static, and then we can do some pre-processing. And in this case, we make what is called deterministic finite automaton. We are going to explain that. Then the case sensitivity issue is easy to handle. Just convert everything to uppercase. Everybody knows does that. The size of the search patterns does not affect the time performance, it only affects memory consumption. Because we are talking about transitions into states, we are going to see that most search algorithms are of this kind. They simulate some kind of finite state machine. The scalability is good regarding the number of search patterns. So if you have 1,000 search patterns, which is way too much for intrusion detection, it will still work efficiently. You will have a longer initialization, but no problem with efficiency of the execution. It can process large alphabets without performance degradation. The average case and the worst case complexity are the same. So no algorithmic attacks. So then it's a big advantage. The setup process is efficient enough. However, it can be very long if you have a lot of patterns that are long. usually they are not that long in intrusion detection, and they are not so many in intrusion detection per signature. So that's not a big problem in intrusion detection. In other applications, it may be a problem. So it is possible to process short packets, that's important, and frequent packets, even more important, in a satisfactory way in the sense of processing cost per byte. So let's go into details of the Ach-Gorosik algorithm, since it's used absolutely everywhere, not just in the IDS, it's used absolutely everywhere. It's very, very popular. It's 50 years old, from 1975, so still used just anywhere. So it consists of two phases. The first phase is the initialization. We can call it initialization, in which we build what is called a pattern matching machine. Now, we have already mentioned that most search algorithms actually simulate a kind of finite state machine. A finite state machine has an initial state, it has states, and it can transit between the states. That's the idea. And if it finds itself in some determined state, it says, I have found the pattern. That's the idea. So what is a finite state machine? Or a pattern matching machine in this case. It's a directed graph that describes transitions between the states of the machine after receiving certain input. That's called event in finite state machine terminology. An event is an input character. So for example, an A arrives to this machine and it finds itself in some state. If from that state it can transit to another state, then it performs that transition. If not, we shall see what is done. So that's the first phase. We build this pattern matching machine. We shall see that it consists of three components. And then in the second phase, the input string is processed and all the patterns from the given set of search patterns are found in a single pass, which is very good. Formally, what we are looking for is the set of search patterns Y1, Y2, Yn, n search patterns. And X is the search string or search text. You will find in literature they call it either text or search string, etc., etc. It's that in which we are looking for our patterns. They, of course, are from the same alphabet. Otherwise, it makes no sense to search for something that is from different alphabet. The search problem is, in general, locate and identify all substrings of X that are patterns in Y. Now, what is the difference between a subsequence and a substring? Substring is a subsequence of consecutive, contiguous. So, for example, if this sensitive is a string, substring is, for example, sen or TIV or whatever, so they are all one after another. And a subsequence is also ESE. So they're not contiguous. So you have to make difference between a substring and a subsequence. So what we are looking for is substrings. So they are search patterns. There may be overlap of these substrings. So we can look, for example, sen and n. So it is overlap. Given the set Y of the search patterns, the pattern matching machine for Y is a structure that takes X as input and produces as output the locations in X where we find the patterns from Y. Very logical definition. Now, what is a pattern matching machine? That's a finite state machine that consists of nodes, and these nodes are called states. The states are labeled with numbers. The machine takes input symbols from X one at a time and processes them by making state transitions, if possible, and occasionally producing output. Sometimes it will not be able to perform state transitions. We shall see what happens then. The output of the machine consists of the patterns from Y together with the state labels where we find them. As we said, there are three components, three functions in this pattern matching machine. The first one is the varigraph, so a go-to transition function that maps a pair state where it finds itself before the input symbol arrives and the input symbol into a state, if possible, if not, into a message fail. Okay? Then, in the case of fail, we have this failure transition function that maps a state into a state. So, you can imagine, the machine finds itself in some state, a character has arrived, the transition is not possible, then this failure transition function says, okay, go to another state and try to match this character again. So, that's a failure transition function. Finally, the output function, O, that associates a set of patterns from Y, possibly empty, because not every state produces output to any state. So at the states where we can find a pattern, then this output function will exist, will be defined. This is very abstract, so we give an example to illustrate the things, and then don't ask me now how I got this. So we are going to find out a bit later. So suppose our pattern set is snow, snort, and or. You see? So we are looking for three patterns in any search string. Remember, any search algorithm that builds finite state machines, not only AlphaCodex, just any, always associates these machines to the set of patterns. We do not know the search string in advance. So the search string has nothing to do, only the patterns, and that's good, because we know what we are looking for. We don't know in what we are looking for that in advance. So the go-to transition function for this set of patterns that is assigned to this set of patterns consists of three paths, snow, snort, and or. You see the paths, and here are the states. And you see, it has a special state, zero state, in which the machine always finds itself in the beginning. And it has a loop. And why this loop? Because it is waiting in this state for either S or O, because our patterns either start with S or with O. If a pattern starts with something else, then it continues waiting in the same state. So that's this loop. So if not, this is not. This sign. So if not O or S, then wait. Stay at zero. So this is our go-to transition function. Now, what happens if we find ourselves into some, for example, state 3, waiting for either W or R, but an X arrives? So then we need a failure function. And the failure function for this set of patterns is this. You see, most of the time, if the failure happens, it says go to 0 and wait. Here, go to 0 and wait. But here, go to 7. And then try to match the character again. If not, then from 7, you will go to 0. See? Here, go to 0. Here, go to 8 and try to match the character again. We are going to exercise this. The rest are 0. See? F is not defined in the state 0 because of this loop. There will be no failures at state 0. So if neither S nor O arrives, then it will remain at 0. Finally, we have the output function. That's very easy. We have at the state 4, if we ever reach the state 4, that means that we have found snow. Then, if we reach the state 5, we have found OR. If we reach the state 6, we have found snort. And if we reach the state 8, we have found OR, but going this way. You see, so there is an overlap between snort and OR. That's why I chose this example, because it's a bit more complicated than usually you don't have overlap. But sometimes you have. So you can have snort and or, they have overlap. So that's why we have branchings, and we have a separate branch and a branch that belongs to another So the question arises, how to get this? Okay? And this, and this. To construct the go-to function and the failure function, so the first two functions, we have two separate algorithms. We are going to call them algorithm 1 and algorithm 2. The output function is constructed during the execution of both algorithms. So it is initiated in the execution of the algorithm 1 and updated during the execution of the algorithm 2. How do we construct the go-to function? The input is the set of search patterns. It starts with a single vertex 0 because that vertex will always exist. You see, the graphs, they consist of vertices and edges. That's how we call them. So the transitions, they are called edges. And the nodes are called vertices. So we start with a single vertex 0. Each pattern from Y defines a separate path in the go-to graph. We have seen that in our example. So snow defines one path, snort defines another path, or defines another path. So we shall have three paths if we have three patterns. The same search pattern is added to the output function of the state at which the path terminates, because then we have found that particular pattern. At the end, we add a loop at the state 0, so we are waiting for just, in this case, S or O. If not, then it remains, in our concrete example, in the state 0. Of course, we are not going into details of these algorithms. You don't have to memorize them on the exam. You will be presented the algorithm, so don't worry about this. So this is how it is done. So we are actually going to exercise this execution a bit. The algorithm 1 is easy to understand. It's relatively easy, so you have one path, another path, third path. But the algorithm 2 is a bit more complicated. Well, the failure function determines the state to which the pattern matching machine transits if a wrong character arrives after the machine has found itself in a state that is not 0. So if it is 0, we know that it is a wrong character. It remains at 0. The failure function is constructed with this algorithm 2 in the breadth-first manner. Maybe you have learned about that in algorithms and data structures, I think, in this subject. At least in Norway, they learn about depth-first search and breadth-first search on graphs. So if the depth of the state S is the length of the shortest path from 0 to that state, the values of F are first determined at the depth 1, and they are always equal to 0. You don't have to go anywhere else from the state at depth 1, just to 0. Now, for some other depth that is not 1, the values of the failure function are obtained based on the values for the depth d minus 1. And the values of the output function are updated during the execution of this algorithm, so it maintains what we call the queue. So we are going to exercise that. So we take some character from the queue, and then we update this queue until the queue is empty. When the queue is empty, then we are done. So the algorithm is finished, and we have this failure function. Now, the pattern matching machine obtained with these algorithms 1 and 2, it's called non-deterministic finite automaton. Of course, it's a simulation of such a thing, because a real non-deterministic finite automaton would be capable of executing the steps in parallel. So that's, of course, not possible. But we simulate that. So in general, it makes more than one state transition after receiving a single input symbol. So what do you think? When it will make more than one state transition? So if you find yourself at some state where the failure function says go to some other state, not to 0. Okay? So it will be one state transition from 3 to 7, and then we try to match the same character from the state 7. So that's already two transitions. And finally, it may be 3 if we cannot match the character in the state 7 either. Then we go to 0. So maximum 3 and minimum 1 transition. So that's a non-deterministic finite automaton. So you can imagine, of course, that we do that in parallel with three copies. That's also a desirable mode of thinking, because we shall see when we talk about bit parallelism that it's exactly what we actually consider. Now, the other possibility is deterministic finite automaton, where only one state transition is possible after receiving the input signal. Now, transforming NFA to DFA is possible for any NFA. So you can make a DFA from any NFA, no matter what complexity of this NFA is. We are interested in relatively simple structures. You see, there are no loops in this, except this one that doesn't matter. So we have open paths. Okay, so transforming this to a DFA is easier than transforming some machine that contains loops, closed circuits, etc., etc. So we don't have that. So it's always possible, and sometimes it's desirable. So sometimes you can configure it to be DFA by default. For this, in the case of Aho Korosik, the authors have proposed what they called a function delta, which is actually DFA that is obtained from this pattern matching machine. That's possible. Before explaining that, we explain how the machine works once you create it. It starts with the state 0, and it will produce a pattern from y in x if it gets to the point where the output function is not empty. So each input symbol starts what we call operating cycle of the pattern matching machine. It starts at 0 and processes one by one symbols of the input sequence, which is actually the search string. So the search string characters are the input to this machine. For any state S and input symbol alpha, the pattern matching machine can either make a go-to transition if we have a state for G of S alpha, or a failure transition if we get the message fail. In the case of a go-to transition, that's the one, the good one. If the output at this new state, the arriving state, is not empty, then it also produces that it found the pattern. In the case of failed transition, then it goes to this new state and tries to match the character alpha again. We can formalize that in this algorithm. We can call it algorithm 3, but you will never follow this algorithm. It's so simple that you will do it by hand. Here is an example, and then we have a break. So, if our search string is snort on snow, and we are looking for three patterns, snow, snort, and or, and we follow that. Just look at the go-to transition function. So it's snort on snow. That's our search string. So S has arrived. Go to state 1. Okay? Then N, and then O, and then R, and then T. Okay? So that's this part. You see? From 0 to 1, from 1 to 2, from 2 to 3, from 3 to 5, from 5 to 6. And here we have produced snort, but we have also produced at the state 5, or, because we have looked for snort, or, and snow. So by arriving to the state 6, we have already found two patterns, snort and or, because there is overlap. So that would be, that would be this, snore here output and here output, okay? Then, what arrives? it is a blank character, so a space. Now you are at the state 6 and the space has arrived, so that's a failure. Okay? So it says, the failure function says from the state 6, go to 0 and try to match the space. Well, if you go to 0, you will remain in zero, at 0. Okay? So the next state in which we are going to be after processing this blank is 0 state. Okay, it will not produce anything. Then O arrives. O is legal. So it says go to 7. But then N arrives. That's also failure. From 7, you see, go to failure function. It says go to 0 and try to match N. You remain at 0. And then we have space again, remain at 0, then S, you see, go to 1, N go to 2, O go to 3, W go to 4, so we have discovered snow as well. So snort on snow will discover, this algorithm will discover OR, snort, and snow. Let's have a break.
Did you think about volunteering for the reference group?
I don't have time, sorry.
Come on. What about you?
Hmm. Yeah, we'll see. If someone else...
Send me an email. Because if you don't volunteer, I will have to volunteer somebody. The participants online as well. If anybody is interested in being a member of the reference group, please send me an email. Because I have to find three persons. So it's better that I get volunteers than to volunteer somebody. It's not so difficult, and besides, now we can have physical meetings, and then I can serve pizza in these meetings. Okay.
I'm not gonna lie, it got more interesting now.
Okay, so send me an email. Okay, then we can continue. We stopped here at processing of an input string by means of the Yahoo-Korosik algorithm. Now, conversion to the delta function, the deterministic finite automaton, we are going to explain that next time when we talk about SNORT, because it uses that. So you will see how that's relatively easy. Now, let's explain bit parallelism phenomenon and exact search algorithms that are based on this bit parallelism. So it's a relatively new thing. So in science, something that is 30 years old result, it's actually relatively new. And of course, since the first paper about this, 30 years have come, have passed. It appears for the first time in 1992, where the phenomenon was explained and the application in search was proposed. And since then, there have been a lot of development. So today, there exists very, very, very efficient algorithm based on bit parallelism. However, bit parallelism is limited in the sense that its efficiency is determined by the length of the computer word. So if you have a 64-bit machine, then you can speed up the algorithm 64 times. However, if you have a longer pattern, then it cannot be processed efficiently. So the length of the pattern is actually limited for efficient processing. However, you will see that in intrusion detection, we don't have so long patterns. Because of that, it's very, very appealing. It has been applied in practice in intrusion detection, this phenomenon in the form of a special algorithm, BNDMQ, that we are going to partially explain. But it was abandoned. And why was it abandoned? The author, it was applied in Suricata. You will see, we are going to mention Suricata and see some details. Suricata is an open source intrusion detection, misuse based network intrusion detection system that is very efficient. It has threads, etc., etc. So it's relatively new since 2009. And they tried this. However, they abandoned that, and why is that? Their default algorithm is now AHO-Korosik again. It was used then as well, but one of the possibilities was to use this bit parallelism, and it was eliminated. They said we talked with the authors. So they said we didn't have resources for further development, but it is this particular algorithm that we are going to mention today. It's sensitive to algorithmic attacks because its average time complexity is better than its worst case time complexity. So this can be exploited. So that may be one of the reasons why they didn't continue with this. However, it's promising, and you will see that there are bit parallelism algorithms, using bit parallelism algorithms, that do not have this vulnerability. So you cannot launch an algorithmic attack against them. And actually, the first algorithm that was described from this family, it is not sensitive to algorithmic attacks. Now we have to explain the bit parallelism, and then from that we explain the algorithms that are based on this phenomenon. You will see that they are extra fast. We have already mentioned deterministic finite automaton. So it's a finite state machine with the property that from each state given an input symbol, you can only go to one branch, one next state. Okay? Just one transition at a time. So that's called deterministic finite automaton. Most automata are of this kind. Non-deterministic finite automaton, on the other hand, is a finite state machine capable of making transitions to more than one state for the same input symbol. In the case of AHO-Korosik, we have seen that it can be three transitions, but they go one after another. They don't go in parallel. But theoretically, this could go in parallel. So a theoretical non-deterministic finite automaton has unlimited parallelism. So one possible interpretation of such a behavior, making transitions to more than one state at a time, is that the machine makes copies of itself in such a situation, and each copy performs one of the possibilities of transition. So you can imagine AHO-Korosik with this. So when you have a failure, that would be a copy of that machine, go to this failure branch, and follow that if possible. So one would think about implementing AHO-Korosik this way. However, they don't do that. But in theory, it's just that. The machine makes copy of itself in such a situation. And that's parallel processing, in theory, infinite parallelism. Each copy then processes the subsequent input symbols independently. So you can imagine such a thing. Now, if after performing such copy making for each symbol and following one of the paths, an input symbol arrives that does not appear as a label of any edge going from out of the reach state, then we kill the machine. So it becomes inactive. So once it cannot follow any path at the input symbol, then it dies in this model. That's very important. So it, you cannot revive it. So we said the machine becomes inactive. If the machine is inactive, it's dead. You never use it any longer for the next characters. The machine that is not inactive, it's called active. So it can still process characters. Now, each of these machines may reach the final state in which, if it reaches that, we say that we have found our pattern. So we say the input string is accepted or recognized. That's the terminology that is used in general, not in IDS. As we said, any NFA can be transformed to a DFA. Now, if NFA is general with loops and all that, that's complex. So time complexity, that's the problem that is NP-complete. Actually, NP-complete problems, you know that, they are most difficult problems. But a special case where we don't have loops, like our algorithms that have a linear structure, our machines, they're actually transformed to NFA, from NFA to DFA very easily. So, a special case, no loops, except this at state zero eventually. This transformation can be performed in polynomial time. NFA is something that we focus on today. They can be presented in two ways. One is with so-called epsilon transitions and without epsilon transitions. Now, what is an epsilon transition? It's a transition that doesn't consume an input. So the machine can just like that go from one state to another without any input, without any, without any input character. So that's this infinite parallelism. So the machines just jump from one state to the other for no particular reason. In both cases, with or without epsilon transitions, such an NFA recognizes all the suffixes of the corresponding search pattern. Now, what is a suffix? Well, the name says, so if we say string, so this is the string, okay? Now, the suffixes are string, tring, ring, ing, ng, and G. That's a suffix. Without epsilon transitions, in the state 0, the NFA expects the first symbol of the search pattern in the search string. We say that 0 is always active, an active state, okay? Which means there is a copy of the machine that is in the state 0. If a machine is made inactive while at the state X, we say that X is an inactive state. All this sounds very complicated, however, it's easy. Here is an example on which everything will hopefully be clear. Let's say that the search pattern is AABCC. So we are looking for AABCC in some string that we don't know. Okay, so without epsilon transitions, this is the automaton. You see, very easy. A, B, C, C transitions. You see, double circled is the final state. And if we get to the final state, we have found the pattern, A, A, B, C, C. So each input symbol, now pay attention how this works. So each input symbol, so the next symbol from the search string, drives creation of a new copy of this, so the same machine, and this copy is in the state 0. And then it tries to match the character. And the remaining copies previously created, if active, they also try to match the character. So they all work independently. With epsilon transitions, the machine is considered receiving substrings. So it receives an input string. An active state of such a machine is the one that corresponds to the end of this path, if it exists, starting from the initial state to that state. And here is an example, the same thing. We are looking for AABCC. This is the machine. It's the same as without epsilon transitions. But you can imagine that in the beginning, we are at some imaginary state I, where we can jump to any of these states depending on what substring has arrived. So if we have received the input string A, very short substring, we can be there in parallel. One copy here at state 1, one copy here at state 2. If we have received AAB, we go directly to 3, because it corresponds to AAB from the beginning. But if we receive ABA, ABA is impossible. So then this machine dies. Now, we shall see why we need all that. Suppose that the search string in which we are looking for this search pattern AABCC is this, AAABC, AABCC. You see, our search pattern is obviously found in the end. But in the beginning, there will be a lot of letters that will confuse us. Because you may hope, if you find two A's, that the next will be B, but it will not. So we shall see what happens. So without epsilon transitions, this is our pattern matching NFA, AABCC. Okay, if we reach the state 5, we have found AABCC. So each time a new symbol from this string S arrives, the machine makes a copy of itself and starts from the zero state. So how will that look like in practice? In practice, we do not have infinite parallelism. We have finite parallelism. So we simulate the NFA, okay? Which means the maximum number of machines running in parallel is equal to the length of the search pattern. In our case, it is 5. Okay, so we never have more than 5 machines in parallel. In our example. Now, if we denote by J the number of processed symbols from S so far, then we always have minimum of J and M machines running in parallel. So in the beginning, we shall have less than M. We start with 1, and then with 2, 3, 4, 5, and then after 5, we always have just 5. So we have to forget something to maintain always 5, maximum 5 parallel copies of the machine. After processing J symbols from S, some of these machines are active and some die because they cannot process the next symbol. We define what we call search status word D, whose length is M, the length of the pattern, and these are the bits, D5, D4, D3, D2, D1. We set DI is 1 if the machine is active, otherwise it's 0. So if the machine, some of these copies is dead, then at this place, for example here, we shall have 0. If it is still active, we shall have at this position, for example, 1. So you see, to simulate such a machine, you don't need these copies of the machine. The only thing that matters is whether it is active or not. So we just maintain the search status word in the whole algorithm, not the copies of the machine. Of course, all the machines are active at the time of creation, since all they are in the state 0 when they are created, and they try to match the next character. And here is an example from which everything should be clear. Now, our search string is AAABC, AABCC. And what we are looking for is AABCC. So let's see what happens. So first character that arrives is A. Okay? So at arrival of this character, we create a new copy of the machine, AABCC. You see? This T is the search status word. So this is not maintained in memory. What is maintained is just that. But we imagine that it exists. So A has arrived, we create the whole machine. It's in the state 0, so we try to match A. It is possible, of course, because it is expecting A from the state 0. So this machine will be active after the first character. Then another A arrives. Okay, we create a new copy. And also try to match A, that will work. And the previously created one will also try to match this one, the new character, and it will succeed. So it will still be active after two characters. Then the third character arrives. We create the third copy. Also works because it is expecting an A. The second one also expects an A, so it will work. But the first one, it expects a B. And A has arrived, so it dies. So its corresponding search status bit will be now 0. In this word. Then B has arrived. We create a new machine. It dies immediately because it is expecting an A. The previously created one, it was still active. It was expecting an A. It dies. The previously created one was expecting a B. So it remains alive, but this one is already dead, so you forget about it. So it remains 0 forever in this search status word. The next one is C. We create the same way. So this will die, this will die, this will die, this remains active, and this is already dead from before. So after all these characters, A, 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 B, C, we have just one machine active. And that's this one. So the first bit is 0, that's this machine. The second bit, that's this machine. It was expecting a C, it was active, so it has received AABC, so it's still alive. You see? The third one is dead. The fourth one is dead. The fifth one is dead. So these are these three zeros. Now we have reached the maximum. Okay, so we cannot have more machines in parallel. So what happens when we receive the next character, which is A? So we have to forget this one. So this bit we have to forget. How do we do that? We shift left. This status word. So we shift it left. So it will be 10000. Then how do we create the new machine? We OR with 1. Okay, because the new machine is always active. It's in the state 0. So we first shift left, forget this machine. Then OR with 1, that's creating the new machine, which is active by default. Now, the third step is to check whether it will process this new character. So will it remain active after creation? So this will be, you see? So it because it's expecting an A, and A has arrived, so it's this. Now the question arises, how do we do that? How do we achieve it? So this was easy. Forgetting a machine, shift left. No problem. Creating a new machine, okay, OR with 1. OR with 00001. So we get 10001, okay? And finally, what happens if we create this machine? Will it be capable of processing the next character? So how do we get 00001 from this? Now, the trick is that a machine that is active at some position always expects the same character. So with a little concentration, you will get this conclusion. So the position of the machine determines which character it expects. So machine at this position always expects an A here an A, here a B, and here a C, and here a C. So in history, backwards. So, an A will always keep the machine D1 active, an A will keep the machine D2 active, a B will keep the machine D3 active, a C will keep the machine D4 active, and a C will keep the machine D5 active if they were active before that. If they were dead, doesn't matter, because it's zero. Since it is always the same, it can be pre-computed. So that's what we call a bit mask. So we create bit mask that only depends on the search pattern. So we can do it in advance. We do it once and this will serve forever. So we can use this property for updating the search status word automatically after each shift left and ORing with one by introducing these bit masks. So for each character of the search pattern, we shall have a separate bit mask. Okay, so for example, this is formal, you don't have to look at that at all, but the example will give you the rule. That's actually very easy. If our search pattern is AABCC, the bit mask for A will be 00011. Wherever we have an A, we have a 1. Of course, backwards, because that's history, eh? B, it will be 00100. Well, we have a B here in the middle. And finally, the bit mask for C, it's 11000. So where we have a C, we have a 1. Okay? I hope you understand that. That's very easy. So AABCC. Wherever you have some character, its corresponding bit mask has a 1 at that position mirrored. Just that. So it's mirrored. So here you have A on the first two positions. That means that one will be on the last two positions. C on the last two positions, that will be the first. And B is just one, so one. Now, what do we do with bit masks after shifting? You see, so the new search status word will be the old one shifted by one, that means forget the oldest copy of the machine, or with one, create the new machine, and then check whether this new machine will be active, and the others previously will remain active on this character, by ending with the bit mask. If the character is not in the search pattern, its bit mask is zero, all zeros. So if you end with all zeros, you get all zeros. This is the whole algorithm. So the whole search algorithm is just this. A very, very clever thing. That was a big step forward in the theory of search. So you can imagine, the only thing that is, you see, these are bit operations. So shift, end, or, that's very fast. And you do it in parallel for the whole computer world. So if you have a search pattern that is shorter than 64 bits, you can do 64 at a time. So it's 64 times faster than anything that goes serially. What happens if you have a longer pattern? Then you have to concatenate the words, and that takes time. So that's the problem of these algorithms. However, if you have special hardware, for example, ASIC or FPGA, you can have longer words if you need longer patterns. However, in IDS, it's not necessary in most cases because our patterns are not that long, which means this algorithm can be easily used in IDS. Its average time complexity is the same as the worst time complexity, so it's not sensitive to algorithmic attacks. Now, the only thing that is missing here is to check where we find the pattern, where we have reached the final state, and that's done by bit testing the MSB. You see? So if MSB becomes 1, that means that we have a match. MSB, most significant bit of this search status word. because in our case it will be that would mean that we have found a C after AABC in our example. So for the step that we have illustrated on this picture, the step 6, the update of the search status word would be shift the previous one, D5 shifted left by 1, so that's this one, that was D5. So shift left by 1, that's 10000. Then all with 1, all with 1, 00001, it's always the length M, the length of the search pattern. So you will get 10001. And then A has arrived, so end with a bit mask for A. And that will make 00001. So this would die as well. So we shall only have one of these parallel copies alive after this sixth character. Now, this algorithm is called shift-end. So, we have, it only has two steps. One step is shift-left or with 1 and end with the bit mask, and the second step is check if the MSB is 1, so bit test. So, you can imagine, this is ultra-fast. Here is an example. So let's run it. If the search string is original and we are looking at origin, okay, where is this in this string? Of course, the first characters. Now, we look at the characters that are contained in the search pattern, O, R, I, G, N. For each of them, we produce bit masks. That's very easy. So for O, it will be 00001. Now the length of the pattern is 6. So we have 6 parallel machines at a time. So O is on the first position, so its corresponding one will be the last one. Okay. Then R here, second from the right. I you have twice. So you have here and here. O, R, I, G, I, N. Okay. Then you have G, that's fourth from the right, and you have N, which is the first one. This is the last character. So these are the bit masks. We do it once. So any search string can come now. We don't care. We don't know what the search string will be in advance. So we just have origin. That's the search pattern. We produce this bit mask, and now we wait for the search string. The search string arrives, O arrives first. Okay? Of course, in the beginning, the search status word is all zeros, nothing active. Now, the first character from the search string is O. The corresponding bit mask is 000001. So what we do is shift left this one, 0 again, or with 1, so it will be 00001, and end with 00001, with the bit mask of O. So we get 000001. That's here. Yeah. So that's one character. Then R, the same thing. Shift the previous state by 1, or with 1, and end with the bit mask of R, O, R, etc., etc. And we get this. Then I, you see, the bit mask has two ones. Then shift the previous state by 1 or with 1. It will be 000101. And then end with this and you get 000100. Then G, the same thing. I, the same thing. And end the same thing. But now MSB, you see, MSB is 1, so we have found our pattern. So we have found origin in original. Now, of course, the algorithm continues because in the search string you can find origin many times. So you don't know that in advance. So the next character is A. Now, the bit mask for A, there is no A in origin. Because of that, its bit mask is all zeros. So whatever was the previous status word, it will be zeroed out. Okay, with this. And finally, L, we don't have L in the search pattern, the same thing, so it will remain zero. So this will be the final state of our search status word after processing the whole search string. But we have found the pattern before that. Now, here is one small trick, and with this we shall actually almost finish. So the Shift-OR algorithm is actually just a variant of Shift-AND, which is actually 33% faster. And why is that? Imagine that we complement everything. We complement the search status word, and we say 0 is active, 1 is inactive. And then we say that if the MSB is 0, then we have found the pattern. And the bit masks are complemented as well. Okay? In this case, we have ORing with 0. So we don't need ORing at all. So we can save one operation out of 3 in this instruction. So then we would have just Shift and OR. So instead of ending with the bit mask, we OR with the bit mask because 0 is active. So something OR 0 becomes remains that something. So if it was inactive, ORing with 0 will not change that. If it was active, it will remain in 0. So it will remain active. You see? So instead of using this update formula, so shift the previous one by 1, OR with 1, and end with the bit mask, we shift, we forget the last, the oldest copy of the machine, don't OR, because that would be ORing with 0, so it would not change anything, and OR with the bit mask. So it's just two operations, shift and OR. That's why this variant of the shift and algorithm, which is from 1992, so it has been noticed that it can run even faster just by complementing. So we have just that as the search status word update formula. So the new search status word obtained by shifting the old one and ORing with the bit mask that is complemented. So the check is whether MSB is 0, not whether MSB is 1. And the same example now, origin in original, you will see that, you see, the complemented bit mask. So origin, you have 0 at the position of O. And here O, R, and you have I twice, you have G, you have N. You see? The search status word in beginning is not all zeros, it's not all ones, all inactive. Again, the first character arrives all, so OR and shift and OR, and you will get this. So it's the same. It's just one operation less. So shift OR is sometimes not considered a separate algorithm. It's considered a variant of shift and. It's the same logic, same algorithm. Actually, the authors, in the beginning, they didn't call it shift AND. They call them shift AD for some reason. But nowadays, it is referred to as shift AND. And this one, its variant is shift OR. Now, we finalize this discussion by actually discussing what was really used in IDS. The logic is the same. It's a different function for update of the search status word. So it's called BNDM, backward non-deterministic DAUG matching, where DAUG is directed acyclic word graph. But this is going to be discussed next time. Okay? So I think shift end and shift OR is enough for today. So try to concentrate. You will see that it is actually pretty easy. Okay, so see you on Monday. We continue with this. So we'll explain how this was used in concrete ideas.
6 years. No, the topic is supposed to have something to do with the idea. Yeah, think about that. You can, it can be whatever. Just try to relate it somehow. That's what the case here as well.